Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, the 15th of July, 2013. And our big burning question is, does Dianne Feinstein, the senator from California, know she's been a target of the NSA?
Hello, NSA. I just called you to say I love you.
I love you
because you really listen.
Now, this is Roy Zimmerman's satirical song, but it begs an important question.
Now when I'm on the phone, will I never feel alone? 'Cause you're out there with your headphones.
Hello.
And you really listen.
Now, we know that Senator Feinstein, chair of the Intelligence Committee, loves the NSA. She supports the surveillance of Americans. And she has been in a catbird seat here, where, because of her security clearances, she should know all of the activities of the NSA. Not only due to those security clearances, but because of her oversight responsibility. As chair of the Intelligence Committee, the NSA is directly under her purview. And about a month ago, Sibel Edmonds and I got our exclusive interview with Russell Tice, the NSA whistleblower. And it still lingers with me that he just very clearly stated that Dianne Feinstein had been the target of wiretaps and other surveillance. And so today I did a follow-up interview with Russ Tice. It's briefer, under 20 minutes, and it gets right down to the nub of the issues. Does the chair of the Intelligence Committee know that she herself has been a target of what is described as a rogue agency, the NSA? Here's an excerpt from that interview with Russ Tice.
Well, at the time, I was finding out that a lot of politicians and judges, to include Supreme Court judges and FISA judges and other federal judges and even people in the executive committee, or executive branch, I should say, were being wiretapped by NSA. So one of the individuals as a leader in the United States Senate was Miss Dianne Feinstein, who had her telephones tapped. As well as her staff, her family phones were tapped, her congressional offices in California were tapped. So they were very thorough. And now this was just the phone side. NSA also went after all of the communications as far as their computers too. But the information that I had direct, hands-on relationship with were the phone numbers that were being tapped and the system that went after the phone numbers once you plugged in the target. And the target set for this particular time would be Senator Dianne Feinstein.
So and what was the time frame, Russ, of the surveillance of Senator Feinstein, to your knowledge?
It would have been, I don't think I saw her with the satellite stuff. So it would have been 2004-2005 time frame.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then it continued on, but after 2005, I was sort of doing a little kabuki dance with the FBI. So it was hard to have any more meetings with my sources at NSA, and it was after that. It was just a lot of being followed by the FBI.
Okay. And so you have direct knowledge that Senator Feinstein was wiretapped starting in 2004 or 2005?
That's correct, yes.
And can you provide any proof of that?
Well, if you're referring to tangible proof, we made sure that we did not have tangible proof on our, even when we had it, that we got rid of it. So hard copy, no. Eyewitness proof, yes. I have other people that saw this as well. Unfortunately, they're not real happy about wanting to become public anytime soon.
You can hear the full interview with Russell Tice. It's available today for all, no subscription required, at peterbcollins.com. And as you can tell, I really think this is a critical issue. The revelations of leaker Ed Snowden are important, and we'll get to some updates on those in a moment. But this gets to the central issue of whether our government leaders are compromised by the spy system that so many of them fully embrace. And they could be compromised in a number of different ways, but the most extreme would be blackmail. And as you listen to Russ Tice talk about the NSA's collection, not only on Senator Feinstein, but the Supreme Court, elected officials, military leaders, and others, it really raises very serious concerns about the independence of our elected officials and their ability to regulate an agency that collects all information, including plenty of dirt, including dirt on our top leaders in this country. And I encourage you to take the interview, post it on Facebook, tweet it out to your friends. If you know reporters, I'm interested in getting as much coverage on this question as possible. I would try, but I don't think Senator Feinstein's staff would agree to let me interview the senator. And so I'm going to feed this to other reporters and journalists and see if they have the same level of concern that I do and see if they will ask Senator Feinstein. And if she knows she has been under surveillance, is she comfortable with that? Does she believe that every American, right up to our top elected officials, should simply submit and adopt the mantra, we have nothing to hide, so go through our garbage, go through our mail, intercept all of our communications? It's an important question. Does Feinstein know that she's been wiretapped, and if so, what is her reaction? I'm going to work hard to get an answer, and I'll keep you posted. Glenn Greenwald says that Edward Snowden has very sensitive blueprints detailing how the National Security Agency operates that would allow someone who read them to evade or even duplicate NSA surveillance. Greenwald told the AP that the former NSA systems analyst, Ed Snowden, has literally thousands of documents that constitute basically the instruction manual for how the NSA is built. In order to take documents with him that proved that what he was saying was true, he had to take ones that included very sensitive, detailed blueprints of how NSA does what they do. Now, some of this appears to be insurance to protect the safety of Ed Snowden as he tries to navigate temporary asylum in Moscow and permanent asylum. It appears Venezuela is the place where he would like to land. And of course, there is this Putin pledge that if he accepts asylum in Moscow, that he has to stop leaking. And as I mentioned on Friday, it's not clear whether Ed Snowden's interpretation of stop leaking means that information he's already delivered to Greenwald and others can or cannot be published. And there was a phone conference call, or a private call, with Putin and Obama scheduled for Friday. And while I've read confirmation that the call did take place, we don't know too much about it. And now it's standing room only in the federal courts. Emphasis on the word standing. That's the subject of the next two items here in the PBC News and Comment. Jerry Marcon, writing in the Washington Post today, correctly notes that the Snowden disclosures and the government's confirmation of some of these disclosures mean that people can sue because they now have proof that they were subject to unlawful, unconstitutional surveillance by our own government. Here is Stephen Vladeck, an expert on national security law at American University Law School. Quote, There's one critical difference from the Bush era. We now have indisputable physical evidence that the conduct being challenged is actually taking place. In recent weeks, three lawsuits have been filed challenging the constitutionality of the phone records collection program, one by the ACLU federal court in New York, another in federal court in Idaho by a nurse who's a Verizon Wireless customer, and a third coming from the conservative group Judicial Watch and Larry Klayman, the founder of that group. And I welcome conservatives to the battle to restore our Fourth Amendment and other elements of the Bill of Rights to full effect in this country. Last week, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, we talked about this, filed a petition with the U.S. Supreme Court asking it to vacate what it called the unlawful order to Verizon that was disclosed by Ed Snowden. The records, this is a quote, the records acquired by the NSA under this order detail the daily activities, interactions, personal and business relationships, religious and political affiliations, and other intimate details of millions of Americans. I would only add the word innocent before Americans. Millions of innocent Americans who are not suspected or charged with anything remotely approaching a crime. And here in San Francisco, Cindy Cohn, the great legal director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, said the state secrets argument doesn't apply in cases involving electronic surveillance. She pointed to last week's decision by a federal judge here, which rejected the government's efforts to throw out, on state secret grounds, a 2008 lawsuit brought by EFF that includes earlier incarnations of the NSA's surveillance programs along with the current ones. So, we have standing. And Adam Liptak, the legal affairs and Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times, picks up from there. He takes us back to last October 29 as Hurricane Sandy was ravaging the East Coast and the Solicitor General Donald Verrilli was making arguments to the Supreme Court. And they used his arguments to dismiss a wiretapping case that was announced during this term, based largely on the assertions of the Solicitor General. So, Liptak reports that Justice Sotomayor asked Verrilli, is there anyone who has standing to sue over wiretapping? Verrilli said yes, giving what he called a clear example. And he went on, if the government wants to use information gathered under the surveillance program in a criminal prosecution, the source of the information would have to be disclosed. The subjects of such surveillance, he said, would have standing to challenge the program. Now, this is coming back to haunt Verrilli and the entire Supreme Court, or at least the 5-vote conservative majority. Verrilli went on to argue that the government must provide advance notice of its intent to use information obtained or derived from the surveillance authorized by the 2008 law against a person in judicial or administrative proceedings, and that person may challenge the underlying surveillance. So the court basically embraced his language, and I believe it's Sam Alito, who, by the way, Russ Tice singled out for mention. Sam Alito was wiretapped after he was nominated to the Supreme Court. Anyway, Alito wrote the decision and just basically cited Verrilli's assertions and said that, they used the argument that there could be standing to deny standing in the case before them. And here comes Dianne Feinstein again in December. In explaining why the FISA law should be reauthorized, she argued that cases that have been cited in Chicago and Fort Lauderdale were among specific cases where the FISA Amendments Act authorities were used. These cases show the program has worked. These cases now have standing. We don't have to rely on unproven assertions from Senator Feinstein or the Solicitor General. Over the weekend here in Marin County, Nancy Pelosi, leader of Democrats in the House, was attending a fundraiser at a rich Democrat's house in the Tony suburb of Belvedere. And about 100 people showed up to protest. And from all accounts, they didn't get to talk to Nancy Pelosi. She didn't interact with them personally. But they delivered messages on signs and through cheers and chants, some speeches on scene, that we do not approve of her support of the surveillance program and of criminal prosecution of Ed Snowden. And I hope Nancy Pelosi will get that message soon. Since Saturday, the media has just been in hyperdrive because the verdict was returned by the jury in Sanford, Florida, declaring that George Zimmerman was not guilty of manslaughter or second-degree murder in the killing of Trayvon Martin. And I have generally avoided commenting on this case because there appear to be about 200 million experts in the land who heard a 911 tape and who basically, on pre-existing biases, decided that Trayvon was a hero or that Zimmerman was a hero. And so I do think some people were shocked by the verdict. I was not. I haven't followed every little detail of the court case, but it was pretty clear to me that the prosecution didn't prove second-degree murder. And in my opinion, they overcharged and under-prosecuted Zimmerman in these court proceedings. And I will flatly say, I don't believe we have any form of justice for Trayvon Martin whatsoever. And I want to distinguish now, from this point forward, between the legacy, if there is one, of George Zimmerman. His brother Robert is a pretty bright guy who certainly gave Piers Morgan a run for his money on CNN. Or Trayvon Martin. I'm done with Zimmerman. I'm happy to discuss stand your ground laws, self-defense issues, and how to change them in particular to provide full protections for young black males. But the whole Nancy Grace Nation, where everybody is a judge and jury and an expert on the evidence, just drives me crazy. And the media overkill on this is really quite evident. Lawyers will now proceed with a suit against NBC News because of the way they edited one of those. It wasn't a 9/11 call. It was the recording of the police dispatcher talking with George Zimmerman as he was patrolling as a self-appointed vigilante in the area where he ultimately got into a confrontation with Trayvon Martin. And when you look at the transcript, NBC edited the tape in a way that made it seem like George Zimmerman was volunteering to the dispatcher that Trayvon was black, when in fact Zimmerman answered a direct question, is he black? And Zimmerman said yes. Likewise, there's a media organization here in the Bay Area that's in deep doo-doo. The once-respected KTVU, Channel 2 News Department, is on its knees today. It's very interesting because behind the scenes, I learned over the weekend that on Friday, the suits at Channel 2 fired an executive producer. Apparently, it was a very bad blood situation. A lot of feelings were injured in this process. Well, I can't connect the firing of that producer with what happened, but on the noon news, Channel 2 claimed they had an exclusive related to the crash of the Asian Airlines jet at San Francisco International Airport a week ago Saturday. You may or may not know that the National Transportation Safety Board doesn't typically name the members of a flight crew, even in the event of a crash. And so Channel 2 thought they had an exclusive. One of their people in the newsroom got a list purporting to be the flight crew. The names given were somebody's idea of a cute, sick, twisted joke. And let me read these names for you, phonetically, and you'll understand what I mean. The captain was described as named Sum Ting Wong. And the co-pilots were listed as Wee Too Low, Holy Fuck, and Bang Ding Ow. So, in the news department at Channel 2, they tell us afterward that after they got this list, they called the NTSB, and whoever answered the phone confirmed that those are the accurate names. Later, they were embarrassed to learn that the person who answered the phone was an intern and was just trying to be helpful. So Channel 2 allows this to go on the air, complete with the screen graphics listing these names, and the anchor reads through them. And at that point, just about everybody seems to have arrived at the conclusion instantly, we've been had. And I used to respect Channel 2. It was the best TV news operation in the Bay Area. They used to allow longer stories. They had veteran reporters, many of whom have retired or been replaced. And now, unfortunately, it's just treading water with the rest of the tabloid, crime-oriented television news programs in the area. And one of the things that compounds this is that for 3 days before this errant broadcast, Channel 2 was running promos about how they were first and completely accurate. Their coverage of this crash at San Francisco Airport. And so their own self-promotion kind of amplified the boomerang effect of this obvious blunder. Our colleague Jason Leopold, who gave us an in-depth interview last week about Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, hasn't stopped. He announced over the weekend that he has filed a motion in federal court to force the commandant of Guantanamo to disclose the search policy that has required strip searching of many of the prisoners as they go to legal appointments and other reasons when they leave their cells. And he also published a piece at Al Jazeera today regarding a flap over the issues that have arisen about whether or not prisoners and their attorneys are given appropriate confidentiality of attorney-client nature. And Jason has discovered that thousands of pages of legal documents were seized from prisoners during a raid in April during this crackdown following the start of the hunger strike, and that they now have bins of documents and they don't know who they belong to. And while this just seems to be another military-type snafu, we have to recognize that this is probably not the first case where they have been insensitive to the legal issues that clients enjoy with their attorneys. And we know that in the past, these communications have been intercepted or monitored. And so it raises the question if there isn't a secret policy that encourages the violation of the legal rights of the attorneys and their clients. Corporate media is announcing today that more detainees at Guantanamo have abandoned the hunger strike. The official count now is that 81, or about half, of the 166 prisoners are still listed as taking part in the hunger strike. It was up to 106 in the official count, but Independent sources believe that it had reached a level of about 130. And regardless, one can understand that, conducting and sustaining a hunger strike is extremely difficult. And also, the military has been using the start of Ramadan and some inducements, essentially allowing those who break the hunger strike to return to more comfortable communal living conditions that were ended back in April, during the same crackdown that Jason Leopold addresses in his article today. And I certainly don't criticize or second-guess the men who are in such a desperate situation that they're willing to put their lives on the line, and yet a flicker of hope remains that someday they might be released, and so maybe they should stand down from the hunger strike. In Washington, the Senate battle over the filibuster is reaching a showdown expected to happen tomorrow. Harry Reid has loaded up the docket with 7 nominees. And his threat, if Republicans don't give an up or down vote on these 7 nominees, then the very next step is that the Democrats will embrace a measure to modify the Senate rules to end filibusters on these appointments. It wouldn't apply to judicial appointments, and it wouldn't apply to legislation. As you know, I don't agree with those exceptions. And my fear is that while Harry Reid is given a good bluster right now, that he'll cave, like he always does. We've talked a lot on this program about the incredible rate of sexual crimes committed in the United States military. There is abuse, there is rape. It occurs primarily committed by men against both men and women. And we're finally starting to see some important attention paid to this crisis. And over the weekend, the New York Times profiles Major General Margaret H. Woodward. She is setting up a new department and staffing it. And she is in charge of sexual assault prevention and response policies. And in this article, it's pretty honest about the past of General Woodward. And she flatly says that when she was chief of safety for the Air Force, she blew it not once but twice. Where when women who had filed complaints withdrew those complaints, she assumed that that was a legitimate process. And so now she says she's going to apply the lessons she has learned to try to protect women and men in the military. And along the same lines, President Obama has made some very strong statements about what he thinks should happen to those who violate the law related to sexual assault while they're serving in the military. The president said that these people should be automatically discharged, and he said that he believes that, well, here's the quote, those who commit sexual assault in the military should be prosecuted, stripped of their positions, court-martialed, fired, dishonorably discharged. Now, you might say, great, the president is setting an important high standard for the military. But this language may be used by defense lawyers in court-martial proceedings to show unlawful command influence. And this is an important issue. I recognize that. I'm glad the New York Times ran this story, starting on the front page. But no one, including the New York Times in the corporate media, has raised this issue about unlawful command influence in the court-martial of Bradley Manning that is currently underway at Fort Meade, Maryland. We have the president on record. I've got the recording. at a fundraiser in San Francisco, flatly saying that Bradley Manning broke the law. It is improper command influence on a military justice structure where all of the people involved in the adjudication process report to the commander-in-chief. And so, if any one of these cases about sexual assault gets thrown out because of the president's remark, then we've got to demand that the same standard be applied to Bradley Manning's case, and that the inappropriate comments made by Barack Obama should lead to the dismissal of all charges. Well, you can tell when I'm daydreaming, right? That's the end of today's Daydream, and I thank you for listening. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until